So I'm coming to you from the North Carolina Research Campus, and this is a public-private enterprise with 8 different universities, a number of industries, and a USDA presence as well. And the partners on this campus, and it's a fledgling campus. It only began in 2008, which is, of course, the beginning of the economic crisis, not a very good time to begin anything. But our campus has a number of different partners from the University of North Carolina system, plus Duke, and then a number of industries as well. The biggest players, I think, are Dole and General Mills that have driven a lot of the research. And so I'm going to be a little bit more focused here. I'm going to focus on an example of how an industry and how a new enterprise was just driven by our industry partners kind of telling it how to focus. We're located near Charlotte, North Carolina, so inland, kind of trying to be a hub with all of these other biotech centers that are in the North Carolina system. And we're taking it from the ground up, so the ground being the plant material, all the way through human health and nutrition. So the whole focus of the campus is human health and nutrition, biotechnology, all the omics technologies, and how that comes together in order to make products and produce that's important for human health maintenance. So I'm at the Plants for Human Health Institute, which is this in the foreground here. That's the North Carolina State operation on this campus. So I'm the director of that institute. And our motto or our vision statement is leading discovery and delivery of innovative plant-based solutions to advance human health and wellness. Now, I'm an academic researcher. I did 25 years at the University of Illinois before I came to North Carolina. And an academic does research because it's interesting, because they can publish it maybe they can hope that they're going to get some funding for it, some federal funding. But when you have industry partners and you link elbows with these industry partners every day, your research becomes much more grounded. It's not really important what you can discover, or it's not even important if something works. It only makes a difference if it's going to motivate people to accept the product, to take the product, to make a business out of it, because just having success in the lab doesn't make a difference at all. So we try and take a three-pronged approach to the research. Of course, you know, we're looking for natural products, either exotic products or products that are right in your grocery store, and the fruits and vegetables that are of the horticultural trade that have impact on chronic human disease. We have to discover these things. That's the first step. And then, of course, you have to do the validation. You have to do bioassays, whether it be cell culture, animal studies, human clinical trials, that prove that a certain compound in a fruit or a vegetable has anti-diabetic properties, or that it can combat cancer or cardiovascular disease. So that's part of it. But none of that makes any difference, no matter how successful it is, until you can do practical delivery to the consumers. Because no medicine, no matter how good it is, will make any difference if you don't take it, if people don't take it. People will watch Oprah Winfrey, Dr. Oz, a lot of popular television and magazines, and they'll get excited about blueberries are going to save my health. To get them to actually take that step to sustainably use a fruit or vegetable that has a bioactive product, that's another thing altogether. So you can't just discover, you have to find a way to deliver to people in order to make a success of what you're doing. Take food, take healthy food. We know this, and this is preaching to the choir here, right? Because horticulturists know what a healthy diet is. It's heavy in fruits and vegetables, right? Everybody knows this now. Actually, in the United States, especially in an educated population, there's no excuse. Everybody knows what you're supposed to eat. We eat in the United States about 1.8 cups a day of fruits and vegetables. What are we supposed to eat? You guys know? Supposed to eat 5. Some places you'll hear servings, it'll be more like 6 to 8 servings, but that's about 5 cups a day if you put it into that kind of measurement. And why don't we do it? Even educated people. Sometimes we buy things at the farmer's market, we get all excited, we bring it home, and then we're like, oh my gosh, I gotta really cook it now? I've gotta do something with it, I've gotta have a recipe, it's not gonna just be something I can rip out of a box and eat. and they don't like it. Or they'll buy something and get excited about it and put it in the crisper in their refrigerator and forget about it, and it'll be all wilted or damaged or rotten by the time they get to it. Some people think fruits and vegetables too expensive. Some people don't like the way Brussels sprouts taste or broccoli. And it's bulky. It's voluminous. And so there's just all kinds of excuses that people have not to eat fruits and vegetables, even though they know that it's going to save their health, that it really is a way to be proactive about disease, not go with the drug culture, not go with, you know, depending on your HMO, your doctor, but really to be proactive about your own health. So we know that, but we don't do it. So one of the technologies that came out of the campus kind of counteract some of these negatives on why people are avoiding doing what they know is good for their health is called the NutriSorb process. This is something that we worked on in our lab with our colleagues at Rutgers, and Rutgers is actually the lead on this. So at Rutgers University and at North Carolina State University, we found a way to take the active compounds, the phytoactives from fruits and vegetables and herbs and some spices, and actually sorb it into edible protein. So actually take the active compounds, in this case from blueberry juice, and fuse it or complex it with edible proteins so that we have a shelf-stable, dry, edible protein that's got these phytoactives that are shelf-stable for over a year at room temperature and can be used to make functional foods that are easy and convenient, because that seems to be one of the biggest stumbling blocks for people to eat these fruits and vegetables that they need. One of the biggest examples, and one of our clients, if you will, through an SBIR, that or not through an SBIR, but through an industry university consortium that we're in now with Ohio State, actually, is working with the U.S. Army. This is one of the biggest problems. These guys have, they need fruits and vegetables, obviously, but how do you get it into their ration packs? And their ration packs look more like this. It's all things that they could be dropped from a helicopter or from a plane, and it will be shelf stable, and they have very, very strict requirements here. And these guys need the phytoactives. They're a very, very stressful environment, really immunosuppressed when they're in a combat situation, but they don't have the advantage of fruits and vegetables. Seasonal availability, just getting it to them out in the field, it's impossible. These same guys who... and they'll open their ration packs. Let me go back one. So they'll open their ration packs, and my contact at the Army tells me they're all 20-somethings, and they'll just throw at anything that doesn't look interesting, which is most of it, even though all this money has gone into making these things, all this technology, and they'll just eat whatever looks interesting or sweet, and that's it. And these same guys that will do that with their ration packs will have shipped into them and into Afghanistan all these, you know, muscle-building things that they get off the internet or that they can have their parents send to them, in care packages, because they want to be buff. They want to be tough. They want to have, you know, big muscles, and that's their whole focus. They're 20-something guys. So what we thought, if we could take what, you know, instead of the ration packets, to take what they could get, the protein and the phytoactives, and get it to them in this product, in the edible flour would be the way to go. And it's not just in the Army, which is the extreme case, but it could be backpackers, for example. It could be the guy in the backpack. You could be camping or biking or school lunch boxes. There's a lot of situations where you can't carry fruits and vegetables, but a fruit and vegetable protein infusion into a product would be key for human health and also convenience. So we're from North Carolina, so we focused on North Carolina crops. So we used muscadine grape as our fruit, and we fused muscadine grape phytoactives with hemp flour and soy protein isolate, and also we used some whey protein for the muscadine grape. So getting it into shelf-stable flours that had all the polyphenolic compounds from the muscadine grape, but also a heck of a lot more concentrated than it would be in the native grape, just because you can really sorb these things and make a big difference. Another one we used, again, a North Carolina crop. They're big on greens in North Carolina. I've only been there 6 years, and I've met some greens I never knew before. But kale is an interesting one because extremely health protective. It's got all the benefits of spinach in a much more concentrated form, and there's a lot of advantages here. It's mostly glucosinolates, isothiocyanates. The thing that's interesting about kale, or a problem actually with kale, is it's got it's glucosinolates, and then it's got a myrosinase enzyme in it. So if you chop up kale and you don't eat it immediately, this myrosinase enzyme gets activated and it'll turn the glucosinolates into isothiocyanates, which are bioactive but also extremely unstable. So if you chop up kale and you let it sit around for a while, your activity is really going to be gone. This is why I don't understand why people are so much into this juicing. Everybody's into juicing now. It's not, you're not getting the fibers, you're not getting a lot of the good things in your fruits and vegetables, and you're also deactivating a lot of your actives because the enzymes get to work, and the juice is no good unless you eat it immediately or drink it immediately. But anyway, that's another story. So because we had the myrosinase enzyme in kale juice, what we had to do in this case was microwave the kale just a little bit to deactivate the myrosinase enzyme before we did the juicing. And then we could take the juiced kale and get it into hemp flour. We got it into whey as well and soy protein isolate. So, and kale, so the muscadine, the bioactives in the muscadine are polyphenolic muscadine bioactives, anthocyanins, proanthocyanidins, and the whole array of polyphenolics, which are anti-diabetic and cardioprotective. Kale has not only polyphenolic compounds, but it has carotenoids, health protective carotenoids, and the glucosinolates, anti-cancer glucosinolates, anti-hypertension glucosinolates. So, and in this case, you get the phytoactives from the juice into a flour matrix, and you get the phytoactives bound to the matrix, but no sugars from the original product, no other, no pectins, so no other extraneous compounds, just the phytoactives. So, what we found here is that, just looking at that muscadine, so we found that we could concentrate the phytoactive compounds from the muscadine in a powder. And this is with the urging of Dole Foods and General Mills, who are very interested in how can we get things into products we can use that's going to be sensible for us. So we could get the equivalent amount of total polyphenolics in one serving of kale, like 67 grams is the typical serving of kale. We could get it at about 16 grams of a matrix, of a flour matrix, that could be used in a protein bar, like for the Army. That's the Army's interest. Or into a smoothie, or into any other kind of a product where you could just mix in edible protein. Now, the reason it's so high for this one, muscadine WPI, is because the process of mixing kale or muscadine juice with edible protein usually involves mixing it, centrifuging it, getting the supernatant off, pelleting down the flour, which is bound with phytoactives, and that's our product. That's our, we freeze dry or otherwise dry that product, and that's our flour. In the case of whey protein, we can't do that because whey protein is too soluble. And if we actually made a supernatant, half of the, well, not half, but quite a bit of the protein in the whey protein would come off in the supernatant. So in the case of whey protein, we used a different process. We would mix the, adsorb the juices with the whey protein and then co-dry them together, not do centrifugation, not remove a supernatant. We had to do that. In that case, when you're co-drying, you're not removing the sugar in the supernatant, so you don't get a sugar-free product. Don't want a sugary flour. So in the case of muscadine and whey protein, we had to use as the source of the polyphenolics, polyphenolics that were extracted from whey pumice. So pumice is the leftover part of the grapes after you've taken the juice out. It's a waste product in the industry for grapes, for blueberries, for a lot of other things. So we have the pumice, it's still got a lot of the phytoactives, quite a few phytoactives bound to it. If you can extract those out, the sugar's already gone in the juice, and you can co-dry it on the whey protein isolate, and you've got, you know, a sugar-free product that it's really concentrated because you can really load it. Now, carotenoids in kale, in this case, in the kale, we got the polyphenolics in the kale captured, but the carotenoids in the kale were captured and sorbed onto the flour, but they don't concentrate a lot. This is a very low polarity molecule, and the process works best for medium polarity molecules. So for a very low polarity molecule, we got the carotenoids captured, but the amount of carotenoids in one serving of kale, which is the 67 grams, were captured but not highly concentrated. And the stability was not great with kale, with carotenoids either. Carotenoids are notorious for low stability, and it was better than other forms, like powdered forms of carotenoid, but still not great. Whereas the glucosinolates in kale were highly concentrated. Those are medium polarity compounds. Stability was terrific at 4, 20, or 37 degrees centigrade. And we got the amount of glucosinolates in one serving size of kale that, you know, we could get it in 5.6 grams of the fortified powder. So that was pretty impressive that we could get that. Efficacy is important too. So we did do some anti-inflammatory effects of muscadine and kale matrices. And what we found here, a number of other tests, antioxidants, sure, it was off the charts. But anti-inflammatory was important because it tended to be the chronic markers of inflammation that were most depressed in these matrices, by consuming these matrices. So that's what the Army is really interested in, is getting rid of chronic inflammation in their soldiers. So they were very interested in this particular result where we had the furthest leftmost column being the chronic. And then also the functionality of the product was also important to us. Using these polyphenols, not only, you know, leaving health totally out of it, one of the problems in creating a bar in the Army, and we've been working with the Army Dictorate in Natick in Boston, is they try and make these bars, these high protein bars that they know their guys are going to eat, but the bars tend to get hard. It's just a characteristic of when you put a lot of protein into a product, it tends to harden. Bar hardening is real common. And we find that when we complex juice or the phytoactives in juice with the protein powder before we put it into the matrix, it actually lessens that bar hardening. It actually prevents the bar hardening, keeps a soft texture. So that was another important thing. And yield stress. So we found that by making this chimeric protein polyphenolic particle, we would improve foam stability or increase yield stress, again, which is important to formulating the product. So all these things important. And it doesn't want to go. There. Again, efficacy. So we took this protein product, and again, the advantage of having a campus where you have partnership between different entities. Right in my building, right in the Plants for Human Health Institute, we have Appalachian State Exercise Performance Lab. And these guys take athletes or normal people or postmenopausal women, it just depends on what the study is, and do intensive tests with them, usually exercise-related on treadmills or on bikes, in order to test the effect of a bioactive compound on the human metabolism. This is great. We're in North Carolina, so NASCAR country. So we get the pit crews to come in, and the pit crews will line up, and they'll be all on bikes, and they'll be in front of a TV monitor, actually a computer monitor, that'll show them how they're biking, and they're all competing against each other for 2.5 hours, and it smells to high heaven in the lab at the end of the test, but you can really get a feeling for how a bioactive product is influencing inflammation or oxidative stress or other parameters. So we did work on this protein powder. And in this case, the protein powder was fused with blueberry and green tea phytoactives to get it in a very concentrated form to athletes. We had the green tea, it was the equivalent of 2 cups of green tea and 3 servings of blueberries, so it was a lot, only in 40 grams of powder, which they took twice a day, so 20 grams of powder two times during the day. And the exercise design was that they were supplemented with this powder or a placebo for 17 days. So they did baseline blood samples. So for 14 days supplementation, and then at the end of the 14 days, they began 3 days of this heavy, intensive exercise, 2.5 hours exercise bouts. It was treadmills here. You get these guys going to the point of exhaustion. It's called overreaching. So they're not dead yet, but they're getting there. And whoa, and that's kind of loud. But it's competitive long distance runners, 2.5 hours on a treadmill, intensive exercise. And athletes are actually great. You know, you have to pay normal people a lot of money to do these trials. Athletes, if it's going to make them tougher and buffer and they're going to be faster and stronger, they will do it for a song. They let you take biopsies. I don't do it, but my colleagues take biopsies out of the leg muscle before they start the exercise. You ever had sushi, salmon roe, you know? That's what it looks like, except a lot of it. And, you know, and they take it, and they're fine with that. And then they go run for 2.5 hours. Then they biopsy the second leg muscle, and you don't even have to pay these guys very much. It's amazing. But the striking results that we had with this supplementation is we had very characteristic polyphenolic signature in the post-colonic serum, so they were actually doing metabolism in their colon, and there's a phenomenon in exercise, it's leaky gut syndrome, where they actually get a lot more out into the blood serum because of the leaky gut with exercise. So really good polyphenolic signature and enhanced ketogenesis. So bottom line is, at the end of the exercise, the supplemented group came in for their blood draws after exercise, and they still had very high ketogenesis, fat burning. So while they were sleeping, they're burning more fat, which is a good message for athletes. But what I'm showing you here is that we also took the blood of the athletes or the placebo control group and introduced it to HeLa cells that were challenged with virus and measured cell viability. And what we found is in the cell viability in the post-exercise 3-day group, you can see the cell viability very high in the supplemented group, and after 14 hours recovery, very high. So we had higher cell viability with the supplementation, and very importantly, we had lower viral activity in the supplemented group. Now, athletes post-exercise, their biggest problem is viral. There's a well-known phenomenon where they just have, they're immunosuppressed after a marathon. So a lot of athletes will get these viral flu-type diseases, flu-type symptoms after extensive exercise, and it takes a long time for recovery, especially if the viral disease takes hold. We were able to get that virus down and unable to replicate in the control group. So again, with Dole support, and it wouldn't be possible without Dole support, we're able to get that evidence for efficacy that was very important. So the serum collected from these guys, we saw that post-exercise, both viral growth and bacterial growth are very much favored post-exercise. So athletes tend to be very vulnerable post-exercise to these organisms. There was no change in bacterial susceptibility with supplementation, but viral susceptibility was attenuated and viral replication. Now, the last thing about these groups, like the North Carolina Research Campus, which bring together industry and academia and government, it's important for product development and it's important for entrepreneurship, certainly, and tried to show you some of that. But it's also important for those students, because the students that get exposed to academic and industry mentorship at the same time, they're golden in the industry. They have a perspective that really puts them ahead. We began P-Squared EP, the Plant Pathways Elucidation Project, to take advantage of the capabilities of our campus, which is very big in omics technology, and the expertise of Dole and General Mills, to look at the impacts of human health and nutrition of different fruit and vegetable crops, and to look at scientific discovery, educational opportunities, and creation of a knowledge base. So we based it all here on the campus. We got PhD students, a series of PhD students, and each PhD student had 5 undergraduate interns, still do, around them, brought in by the Plant Pathways Elucidation Project. About $2 million in funding that came in from various sources, including General Mills and Dole's and Duke Energy Foundation, but also our general administration kicked in, to mapping the plant pathways for fiber, phytoactives, and you know, targeted crops of blueberries, broccoli, oats, and strawberries. So that's what's going on here. A lot of participation, a lot of partners that all have partnered with us just to bring all this activity onto the campus, and a lot of media and public interest on the project. Actually, Tuesday is the cap off of this summer's activities, where they'll do a symposium and show their results. It's very interesting to see these undergrads get all excited about science and pull it all together and have that link with industry that pulls it together. So I'm that's the end of my time, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
There's been a lot of talk here in the meetings over the last few days on LED lighting and using the LED lighting, you know, 10 days or 7 days before the end of a production cycle of a particular crop. Use that with the blue light, for example, to upregulate the production of certain antioxidant compounds, because you stress them. You're putting a lot of energy into that crop for a short period of time. You've got a lot of zeaxanthin in production inside that crop. You've talked a lot about isolating those particular active ingredients in terms of delivery system into human health. Do you also do work on the upregulation?
Oh, a little bit, yeah, as well. And I do agree with that strategy. And that's one of the criticisms, I don't think a fair criticism, but one of the criticisms of high production cultivated horticulture or row crops is that we are so good to our crops, you know, we regulate the diseases and the insects so that they don't have the stress in the wild, so they have less antioxidants. I'm not quite sure that's 100% true as much as they're touting it, but to deliberately deliberately impose some of these stressors that we know will regulate the pathways is a good way to upregulate the antioxidants and other health protectors.
And so is your institute one of the only institutes that's really doing the forefront research on delivery systems for those actives, or are there a couple of ways to partner with?
I know some industries that are doing it. I don't know about an institute that's really focused. Institutes tend to be more, not really on the delivery, as far as I know.
So for these industrial partners, the funding of the work, you have a preferential terms of intellectual property created.
Yeah, first rights of refusal.
It is just that, or is it?
Yes, it is. It is. This particular company that I featured, NutriServe, and I have some literature on it. We didn't go with angel fund venture capital at all. You know, we just decided not to. We just decided, you know, look, you can license and see what you want. And we actually are very receptive to what they're interested in featuring, and you know, what product they want to make of it. It's going to make a difference in how we formulate.
Just
how does
it taste, the protein?
That's actually one of the good parts of it. You know, because like soy, you know, kind of, you know, or broccoli, but it modulates the sharp flavors, like even cranberry matrix. It does taste nasty like cranberry. All right, everybody knows cranberry is great for urinary tract infection. The problem is, a lot of people hate the taste, and you have to adulterate it with so much sugar in order to take cranberry juice because it's so tart. If you take cranberry juice, sugar-free, sorb it with soy protein isolate, it modulates the flavor. It tastes like pomegranate. And it's actually not bad at all. So that's actually a really big advantage.
The binding process somehow.
It's just because, well, it's actually pretty well known that co-delivery or eating some of these sharp tasting fruits with protein will modulate taste. But here we've actually fused them together.
Yeah.